Chapter 41. Answered Alan, and though he spoke low, his voice trembled with some strong emotion. A first impulse of hesitation which I had I checked, feeling that as I had heard so much it was fairer to go on, and I advanced to the top of the staircase. Alan stood by the fireplace facing me, but far too occupied to see me. His last speech had seemingly aroused George to fury, for the latter turned on him now with savage passion. "Damn it all, Alan," he cried, "can't you be quiet? I will be master in my own house. Take care, I tell you, the curse may not be quite fulfilled yet after all." As George uttered these words, Alan lifted his eyes to him with a glance of awful horror. His face turned ghastly white, his lips trembled for a moment, and then he answered back with one half-whispered word of supreme appeal, "George." There was a long-drawn, unutterable anguish in his tone, and his voice, though scarcely audible, penetrated to every corner of the room, and seemed to hang quivering in the air around one after the sound had ceased. Then there was a terrible stillness. Alan stood trembling in every limb, incapable apparently of speech or action, and George faced him, as silent and motionless as he was. For an instant they remained thus, while I looked breathlessly on. Then George, with a muttered imprecation, turned on his heel and left the room. Alan followed him as he went with dull, lifeless eyes, and as the door closed he breathed deeply, with a breath that was almost a groan. Taking my courage in both hands, I now descended the stairs, and at the sound of my footfall he glanced up, started, and then came rapidly to meet me. "Evie, you here?" he said. "I did not notice you. How long have you been here?" He was still quite white, and I noticed that he panted for breath as he spoke. "Not long," I answered, timidly and rather spasmodically. "I only heard a sentence or two. You wanted George to do something about some tradition or other, and he was angry, and he said something about the curse." While I spoke, Alan kept his eyes fixed on mine, reading through them, as I knew, into my mind. When I had finished, he turned his gaze away satisfied, and answered very quietly, "Yes, that was it." Then he went back to the fireplace, rested his arm against the high mantelpiece above it, and leaning his forehead on his arm, remained silently looking into the fire. I could see by his bent brow and compressed lips that he was engaged upon some earnest train of thought or reasoning, and I stood waiting worried, puzzled, curious, but above all things, pitiful, and oh, longing so intensely to help him if I could. Presently he straightened himself a little, and addressed me more in his ordinary tone of voice, though without looking round. "So I hear they have changed your room." "Yes," I answered. And then, flushing rather, "is that what you and George have been quarreling about?" I received no reply, and taking this silence for assent, I went on deprecatingly, "Because you know, if it was, I think you are rather foolish, Alan. As I understand, two girls are said to have died in that room more than 100 years ago, and for that reason there is a prejudice against putting a girl to sleep there. That is all. Merely a vague, unreasonable tradition." Alan took a moment to answer. "Yes," he said at length, speaking slowly, and as if replying to arguments, in his own mind as much as to those which I had uttered. "Yes, it is nothing but a tradition after all, and that of the very vaguest, and most unsupported kind. Is there even any proof that girls have not slept there since those two died?" I asked. I think that the suggestion conveyed in this question was a relief to him, for after a moment's pause, as if to search his memory, he turned round. "No," he answered, "I don't think that there is any such proof, and I have no doubt that you are right, and that it is a mere prejudice that makes me dislike your sleeping there." "Then," I said, with a little assumption of sisterly superiority, "I think George was right, and that you were wrong." Alan smiled, a smile which sat oddly on the still pale face, and in the wearied, worn-looking eyes. "Very likely," he said. "I dare say that I am superstitious. I have had things to make me so. Then coming nearer to me, and laying his hands on my shoulders, he went on, smiling more brightly, "We are a queer-tempered, bad-nerved race, we Mervins, and you must not take us too seriously, Evie. The best thing that you can do with our odd ways is to ignore them." "Oh, I don't mind," I answered, laughing, too glad to have won him back to even temporary brightness, "as long as you and George don't come to blows over the question of where I am to sleep, which after all is chiefly my concern, and Lucy's." "Well, perhaps it is," he replied, in the same tone, "and now be off to the drawing room, where Lucy is defending the tea table single-handed all this time." I obeyed, and should have gone more cheerfully had I not turned at the doorway, to look back at him, and caught one glimpse of his face as he sank heavily down into the large armchair by the fireside. However, by dinner time he appeared to have dismissed all painful reflections from his mind, or to have buried them too deep for discovery. The people staying in the house were, in spite of my sense of grievance at their arrival, individually pleasant, and after dinner I discovered them to be socially well assorted. For the first hour or two, indeed, after their arrival, each glared at the other across those triple lines of moral fortification behind which every well-bred Briton takes refuge on appearing at a friend's country house. But flags of truce were interchanged over the soup, an armistice was agreed upon during the roast, and the terms of a treaty of peace and amity were finally ratified under the sympathetic influence of George's best champagne. For the achievement of this happy result Alan certainly worked hard, and received therefore many a grateful glance from his sister-in-law. He was more excited than I had ever seen him before, and talked brilliantly and well, though perhaps not as exclusively to his neighbors as they may have wished. His eyes and his attention seemed everywhere at once. One moment he was throwing remarks across to some despairing couple opposite, and the next he was breaking an embarrassing pause in the conversation by some rapid sally of nonsense addressed to the table in general. He formed a great contrast to his brother, who sat gloomy and dejected, making little or no response to the advances of the two dowagers between whom he was placed. After dinner the younger members of the party spent the evening by Alan's initiative, and chiefly under his direction, in a series of lively and rather riotous games such as my nursery days had delighted in, and my schoolroom ones had disdained. It was a great and happy surprise to discover that, grown up, I might again enjoy them. I did so, hugely, and when bedtime came all memories more serious than those of musical chairs, or follow my leader had vanished from my mind. I think, from Alan's glance as he handed me my bed candle, that the pleasure and excitement must have improved my looks. "I hope you have enjoyed your first evening of gaiety, Evie," he said. "I have," I answered, with happy conviction, "and really I believe that it is chiefly owing to you, Alan." He met my smile by another, but I think that there must have been something in his look which recalled other thoughts, for as I started up the stairs I threw a mischievous glance back at him and whispered, "Now for the horrors of the haunted chamber." He laughed rather loudly, and saying "good night" and "good luck," turned to attend to the other ladies. His wishes were certainly fulfilled. I got to bed quickly, and as soon as my happy excitement was sufficiently calm to admit of it to sleep. The only thing which disturbed me was the wind, which blew fiercely and loudly all the earlier portion of the night, half arousing me more than once. I spoke of it at breakfast the next morning, but the rest of the world seemed to have slept too heavily to have been aware of it. The men went out shooting directly after breakfast, and we women passed the day in orthodox country house fashion, working and eating, walking and riding, driving and playing croquet, and above, beyond, and through all things, chattering. Beyond a passing sigh, while I was washing my hands, or a moment of mournful remembrance, while I changed my dress, I had scarcely time, even to regret the quiet happiness of the week that was past. In the evening we danced in the great hall. I had two valses with Alan. During a pause for breath, I found that we were standing near the fireplace, on the very spot where he and George had stood on the previous afternoon. The recollection made me involuntarily glance up at his face. It looked sad and worried, and the thought suddenly struck me that his extravagant spirits of the night before, and even his quieter, careful cheerfulness of tonight, had been but artificial moods at best. He turned, and finding my eyes fixed on him, at once plunged into conversation, discussed the peculiarities of one of the guests, good-humoredly enough, but with so much fun, as to make me laugh in spite of myself. Then we danced again. The plaintive music, the smooth floor, and the partner were all alike perfect, and I experienced that entire delight of physical enjoyment which I believe nothing but a valse under such circumstances can give. When it was over, I turned to Alan, and exclaimed with impulsive appeal, "Oh, I am so happy, you must be happy too." He smiled rather uncertainly, and answered, "Don't bother yourself about me, Evie, I am all right. I told you that we Mervyns had bad nerves, and I am rather tired. That's all." I was too passionately determined just then upon happiness, and his was too necessary to mine for me not to believe that he was speaking the truth. We kept up the dancing till Lucy discovered with a shock that midnight had struck, and that Sunday had begun, and we were all sent off to bed. I was not long in making my nightly preparations, and had scarcely inserted myself between the sheets when, with a few long moans, the wind began again, more violently even than the night before. It had been a calm, fine day, and I made wise reflections as I listened upon the uncertainty of the North Country climate. What a tempest it was! How it moaned, and howled, and shrieked! Where had I heard the superstition which now came to my mind, that borne upon the wind, come the spirits of the drowned, wailing and crying for the sepulture which had been denied them? But there were other sounds in that wind too. Evil, murderous thoughts, perhaps, which had never taken body in deeds, but which, caught up in the air, now hurled themselves in impotent fury through the world. How I wished the wind would stop! It seemed full of horrible fancies, and it kept knocking them into my head, and it wouldn't leave off. Fancies, or memories which? And my mind reverted with a flash to the fearful thoughts which had haunted it the day before in Dom Alice's tower. It was dark now. Those ghastly intangible shapes must have taken full form and color, peopling the old ruin with their ageless hideousness. And the storm had found them there, and borne them along with it as it blew through the creviced walls. That was why the wind sound struck so strangely on my brain. Ah! I could hear them now, those still living memories of dead horror. Through the window crannies they came shrieking and wailing. They filled the chimney with spirit sobs, and now they were pressing on, crowding through the room, eager, eager to reach their prey. Nearer they came, nearer still. They were round my bed now. Through my closed eyelids I could almost see their dreadful shapes. In all my quivering flesh I felt their terrors as they bent over me, lower, lower. With a start I aroused myself and sat up. Was I asleep or awake? I was trembling all over still, and it required the greatest effort of courage I had ever made to enable me to spring from my bed and strike a light. What a state my nerves or my digestion must be in. From my childhood the wind had always affected me strangely, and I blamed myself now for allowing my imagination to run away with me at the first. I found a novel which I had brought up to my room with me, one of the modern, Chinese-American school, where human nature is analyzed with the patient, industrious indifference of the true celestial. I took the book to bed with me, and soon under its soothing influences fell asleep. I dreamt a good deal, nightmares, the definite recollection of which, as is so often the case, vanished from my mind, as soon as I awoke, leaving only a vague impression of horror. They had been connected with the wind, of that alone I was conscious, and I went down to breakfast, maliciously hoping that others' rest had been as much disturbed as my own. To my surprise, however, I found that I had again been the only sufferer. Indeed, so impressed were most of the party with the quiet in which their night had been passed, that they boldly declared my storm to have been the creature of my dreams. There is nothing more annoying when you feel yourself aggrieved by fate than to be told that your troubles have originated in your own fancy, so I dropped the subject. Though the discussion spread for a few minutes round the whole table, Alan took no part in it. Neither did George, except for what I thought a rather unnecessarily rough expression of his disbelief in the cause of my night's disturbance. As we rose from breakfast, I saw Alan glance towards his brother, and make a movement, evidently with the purpose of speaking to him. Whether or not George was aware of the look or action, I cannot say, but at the same moment he made rapidly across the room to where one of his principal guests was standing, and at once engaged him in conversation. So earnestly and so volubly was he borne on, that they were still talking together, when we ladies appeared again some minutes later, prepared for our walk to church. That was not the only occasion during the day on which I witnessed, as I thought, the same by-play going on. Again and again Alan appeared to be making efforts to engage George in private conversation, and again the latter successfully eluded him. The church was about a mile away from the house, and as Lucy did not like having the carriages out on a Sunday, one service a week as a rule contented the household. In the afternoon we took the usual Sunday walk. On returning from it, I had just taken off my outdoor things, and was issuing from my bedroom, when I found myself face to face with Alan. He was coming out of George's study, and had succeeded apparently in obtaining that interview for which he had been all day seeking. One glance at his face told me what its nature had been. We paused opposite each other for a moment, and he looked at me earnestly. "Are you going to church?" he inquired at last, abruptly. "No," I answered, with some surprise. "I did not know that anyone was going this evening. Will you come with me?" "Yes, certainly, if you don't mind waiting a moment for me to put my things on." "There's plenty of time," he answered. "Meet me in the hall." A few minutes later we started. It was a calm, cloudless night, and although the moon was not yet half full, and already past her meridian, she filled the clear air with gentle light. Not a word broke our silence. Alan walked hurriedly, looking straight before him, his head upright, his lips twitching nervously, while every now and then a half-uttered moan escaped unconsciously from between them. At last I could bear it no longer, and burst forth with the first remark which occurred to me. We were passing a big, black, queer-shaped stone standing in rather a lonely, uncultivated spot at one end of the garden. It was an old acquaintance of my childhood. But my thoughts had been Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.